Thanks for joining me for this episode of New Books in Philosophy. I am Robert Talese. I am professor of philosophy at Vanderbilt University. I co-host the program with Carrie Figder. Carrie is associate professor of philosophy at the University of Iowa. My guest today is Linda Zagzebski. Linda is George Lynn Cross Research Professor and Knight Fisher College Chair of the Philosophy of Religion and Ethics at the University of Oklahoma. Her new book, which is based on her 2015 Gifford lectures, is titled Exemplarist Moral Theory. It's published by Oxford University Press. Now, in this fantastic book, Linda develops a novel kind of moral theory. It's a theory according to which the phenomenon of admiring exemplars is fundamental to the theory. This means, in part, that the moral theory that Linda recommends involves a good deal of empirical study, both of the lives of exemplars and the psychology of admiration. And it's also philosophically, meta-ethically, very sophisticated and detailed. So, as usual with philosophy, there's a lot to talk about. But let's begin where we usually do, that is with greeting our guest. Hello, Linda.
Hi, Bob. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you today?
Just fine.
Well, thank you so much for writing the book, and thank you for joining us on New Books in Philosophy. Before we start talking about exemplars and admiration and the rest, Linda, why don't you start us off by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Thanks. Well, my work in philosophy actually started with philosophy of language in grad school in the 70s at UCLA. And I wrote a dissertation on direct reference and the semantics of natural kind terms, which is ironic because I've come back to that in this book with a proposal to use direct reference in the semantics of moral terms. But for decades, I did completely different things. So, as some people know, I began in philosophy of religion, beginning with a book on freedom and foreknowledge. And then I was dragged into epistemology through work in philosophy of religion because
dragged.
In those days, meaning the 80s and early 90s, philosophy of religion was dominated by epistemology. And I had to sit through paper after paper on religious epistemology at conferences, and I found most of it very boring. So I wrote Virtues of the Mind because I thought that there had to be a better way to approach epistemological issues. And what I did is to propose a virtue theory that would encompass intellectual virtues in the same theory as moral virtues, and then showed how I thought that the idea of intellectual virtue can advance discussions in epistemology. But that meant I was also working in ethics, particularly virtue ethics. And I then got the idea of creating a type of moral theory based on direct reference to particular persons, not their traits of character, but the persons themselves. So in this type of theory, I'm using the term direct reference in the sense that became famous in the work of Kripke and Putnam, particularly in the way they define natural kind terms like water, gold, and tiger. So briefly, the term water is defined as stuff like that. Tiger is defined as creatures like that, and so on, where in the simplest case, the word that is used to point to real objects. And what was really fascinating about this theory is that it revolutionized semantics because it meant that we can succeed in thinking about and talking about objects in the natural world without needing a descriptive meaning in our heads. And that was the insight that I was using when I wrote the Christian version of this theory in a book called Divine Motivation Theory. Now, that book was published back in 2004. And the basic idea of that book was that God is the supreme exemplar to whom we refer directly rather than through descriptions. And human exemplars are imitations of the divine. So the idea of using exemplars is really a way of looking at the moral life in which morality attracts rather than compels. And I've always liked that way of looking at morality. I guess you could say it's a more Platonic way of looking at morality rather than a Kantian way. But the Divine Motivation Theory book was focused on puzzles in philosophical theology more than ethical theory. But I discovered that it got attention from some psychologists and education theorists who liked the idea of exemplars as the basis for a moral theory. And then that brought me into conversation with interdisciplinary groups who were doing research on exemplars. And I became a consultant for one of those groups. And I was encouraged to work on a general moral theory based on exemplars. So that was what I decided to do. But meanwhile, I was still working in epistemology, and I wrote a book on epistemic authority, which came out in 2012. So I started working on the Exemplarist Moral Theory book for my Gifford lectures, which then turned into this book. And so that's sort of the long history of how the book came to be.
Well, that's wonderful. And it's always interesting to hear the storied pasts of new books. So let's dive in then. And so, you know, I think you and I will agree that longstanding debates in philosophy, in almost any area, I think, sometimes or often maybe boil down to disputes about where to begin. And so this is clearly true in epistemology, by the way, it seems to me, maybe especially true in epistemology, that the debates are about what's the concept that you begin with or what's the phenomenon you begin with. So in your book, you propose, among a lot of novel thoughts and ideas, you propose a novel conception of where moral theory begins, which is with exemplars and the experience of admiration. But I very much appreciated at the very beginning of the book that you took some time to talk through and to orient the reader towards your conception of what the task of moral theory is or how moral theory works. Mm-hmm. So why don't we begin there? Can you tell us a little bit about what you call your theory of moral theory?
Oh, yeah, my theory of theory. Yeah. I think of a theory as like a map.
Right.
So you can compare it to a geographical map if you wish. So what a map does is to simplify the domain that the map is mapping in order to make it easier for human beings to grasp it. And in simplifying, many things are left out. Sometimes it distorts what's left in. So, for example, on a geographical map, sometimes the lines depicting roads are straighter than the roads really are. That would just be a simple example. Right. Or if you think of a two-dimensional map of the world, think of how it distorts the size, the relative size and shape of countries or continents near the poles. You know, that would be an example. So maps simplify and they distort to some extent. But they do that because it actually aids human understanding to grasp a very large and complicated domain through the medium of a simple structure. And when you think about morality, it's an enormous domain that affects pretty much all aspects of our lives. And it's just too hard for us to get our minds around it without something that helps us structure it. So a map is meant to be, or a theory is like a map that simplifies it for us. And I think of the map as something where you can put more or less detail in it depending upon what your purpose is. So we think, you know, when we look at a geographical map, a lot is missing from the map. But we think that if we wanted to, we would know where to put the buildings on the map, or, you know, if it's a street map, say. And so we want to be able to have something that helps us grasp a large domain with a lot of it missing in order to get our minds around it. But we also want to know where to put the details, to put the pieces of the domain onto the map when it's appropriate. So that means that I think that since a theory is a map that aids our understanding, there's going to really be more than one way to do it.
Right.
So I think there's more than one good map, more than one good theory. But I also think that if the map is used to get somewhere, you know, if you're you can have more than one map of the same city, but if you're going to use the map to get somewhere, it better get you to the same place, to the place you want to get to. So multiple maps should get you, should get the people who are using them to the same place. So I think that for the most part, moral theories do that. Moral theories basically help us navigate the moral life as well as to understand it. And if, even though there can be more than one good moral theory, if we're going to use the theory as a way to get somewhere, that is to know what to do, the maps, the moral theories should tell us the same thing. They should get us to the same place. If they don't, then we know one of them is defective. At least one of them is defective. So that's my general idea of what a map, a moral theory should do. I also have one other feature of my idea, my theory of theory, that I think is unusual. And that is that the theory should have a place for all of the major features of our moral practices. So we should know where to put moral emotions in the theory. We should know where to put narratives in the theory. We should know where to put other theories in the theory. So in other words, the production, the invention of moral theories is one of the pieces of our moral practices that a moral theory should explain. So I think a good moral theory should explain how it is that other theories, you know, where the other theories fit on the map.
Well, that, let me pick up on that, because that was a refreshing feature of your account. It's odd, perhaps, that at least from my perspective, it seems odd that moral philosophy is one of the more combative areas of philosophy. And so it's not uncommon, you know, to read even very contemporary work in moral philosophy where, you know, a person is arguing against, you know, the competing conception of, you know, the meanings of moral terms, or the semantics of moral statements, or, you know, truth and falsity in moral matters. And you emerge often with the idea that, wow, this person can't understand how, you know, this anti-utilitarian can't understand why there are any utilitarians in the world.
Right.
Or this guy, you know, this utilitarian thinks there shouldn't be any Kantians. There's nothing. Kantians aren't tracking anything. That always seemed to me like a like an unfortunate feature of the way the discourse sort of pans out.
That's right. That's right. You could compare, you know, just to go back to my map analogy, there are different maps of the same region. Some maps concentrate on roads and political borders, and others depict the contour elevations and elevation contours, mountains and that sort of thing. They depict different things, but yet they both represent reasonably accurately, you know, in different degrees, the same thing.
Right.
But they pick out different features. I do think, as I mentioned a minute ago, that it isn't that all moral theories are equal.
Right.
I think some do a better job than others of depicting the features of our moral practices that we really want to grasp. Some are more comprehensive than others. I actually think it's an advantage when it's simpler. Some are simpler than others.
Right.
But when you look at the major moral theories, they, for the most part, they tell us to do the same things. So that's like maps that are, you know, two good maps that tell you, you know, if you use them, you'll get to the same location. So, but of course, if they don't get you to the same place, then that's a defect of one of them.
Right, right, right. Great. So that's all very helpful. Why don't we dive into the exemplarist theory then? So maybe the place to start is with the most general question, and I'll ask you in responding to it to pick up on some of the things you were saying when you were telling us about the genesis of the book.
Sure.
So why don't we just say, like, so tell us a little bit, what's an exemplar? How does admiration work? And
sure,
what is the direct reference background to all to the view?
Thanks. Yeah. Yeah. So briefly, what I mean by an exemplar is a person who's supremely admirable. And I propose that we pick out exemplars through the emotion of admiration. Now, the emotion of admiration can change upon reflection. It's shaped through experience and through traditions that pass on narratives of admirable persons. But we identify exemplars not through the possession of descriptive properties known in advance, but directly as persons like that, and we point to people we admire, you know, people like Gandhi or Confucius or St. Teresa of Calcutta or Holocaust rescuers, or it could be your own grandmother.
Right.
And then I propose that we discover what makes an exemplar through observation, including, and when I say observation, that would include not only personal observation, but narratives that others tell us and controlled empirical studies. So that would be parallel to discovering what makes water water by empirical observation. So we find out by observation that water is H2O. And I propose that we find out by observation that an exemplar has a certain kind of motivational structure, which we typically describe using virtue terms. So the word water does not mean H2O. We discover that it's H2O. And the word exemplar does not mean person who is kind, generous, just, etc. We discover the traits of exemplars through observation. And I think that the set of exemplars has more than one function. I think it forms the basis for a theoretical map that serves the function that I described a minute ago. It's a philosophical purpose in which I define terms like virtue, good motive, good life, right act, and other moral terms by the properties of exemplars. And this theoretical map is meant to simplify the moral domain by picking out key moral concepts and linking them together to the properties of exemplars. So that's the theoretical purpose is one purpose that's served by picking out exemplars. But there's also a practical purpose because admiration is motivating, and in the right conditions, it leads to emulation. So exemplarism is intended to be a theory that makes us want to be better persons in addition to understanding the moral domain. And I think that that means it can also be used in moral education. And I think there's actually another advantage. Many people in recent years have said that moral philosophy ought to be responsive to empirical work. And this theory actually incorporates empirical studies as well as narratives into the body of the theory itself. So my idea is to produce a structure for mapping the moral domain into which we can place narratives about exemplars and the results of empirical work. So that's how it's supposed to go.
Well, wonderful. So there's a lot in there. So let me ask you to unpack a couple of things. But let me begin then. Maybe this is one of the places where your sort of approach to moral theory does look like it's got a bone to pick with. It might not be so ecumenical as maybe one would like, because the reliance on the direct reference semantics does seem that it is running against the current of a lot of work in metaethics. And think about G.E. Moore, for example,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Sort of, you know, even soft versions of the Moore view are still very prevalent, which say, Well, no, moral theory has to begin with definitions, or moral theory has to begin with necessary and sufficient conditions for something's having the property of being good or being right. Mm-hmm. So could you just draw that contrast a little
sure.
bit more?
Yeah. Yeah. So that's good. That's a very good question, because I definitely want to reject the idea that moral theory begins with definitions, begins with necessary and sufficient conditions for being a virtue or a right act or whatever it might be, and instead should begin by direct reference to exemplars. Now, that being said, remember, I was proposing a theory of theory in which this is not the only way to do a moral theory, but I like this way of doing moral theory. For one thing, I think it fits the way we actually use language better than other theories. And it also, well, it has other advantages we can talk about later. But when I say that we should begin by direct reference rather than by descriptions, I really mean that to be taken seriously. And the reason it's ecumenical, as you put it, is that I think that in the theory itself, we can explain how it is that other theories develop. I mean, I have a place for moral emotions in the theory, I have a place for moral philosophy in the theory. You know, moral philosophers get a function, you know, in this theory. And there's a place for empirical scientists in the theory. So it's in a sense a meta theory, I guess, because it's a theory that has a place for other theories.
Right. Excellent. So just a little bit more. I mean, I suspect many of our listeners will be familiar with the Putnam-Kripke stuff. But sure. Can you just spell that out just a little bit more to people who, you know, might not remember their grad school philosophy of language class?
Right. Of course. Okay, so there's a number of levels at which I use the Putnam-Kripke theory, but the most basic one is just the direct reference.
Right.
That what I mean by a good person or admirable person is a person like that. And then we point to a set of exemplars of people we admire, and that means we admire upon reflection. I mean, admiration changes with reflection, and it changes as, over time as traditions develop and the course of history tends to change the set of exemplars that we pick out. So an exemplar, we pick out an exemplar directly through the emotion of admiration. Now, of course, there's nothing in the Putnam-Kripke theory about admiration. I mean, you just point to water. I mean, there's nothing that serves. Yeah, you don't need an emotion or anything like that in the Putnam-Kripke theory. But then it's very important. It's really critical in their theory that meaning is external to the mind, or at least partly external to the mind, because the meaning of water is stuff like that. And I also want to say that the meaning of good person is persons like that. And then you find out what that is by observation. So the Putnam-Kripke theory was one of the things that was really novel and interesting about it was that it smoothly connected semantics with science. So the semantics sort of tells you where to look, and then the science does the looking. And my theory is similar to that in that, you know, our direct reference to exemplars through emotion tells us where to look, and then we look, but there's more than one way to look. I mean, you can talk to them if you know them. There's narratives that are passed down or spread throughout a culture that describe them. And more recently, there have been empirical studies of exemplars. So all of these ways of looking at exemplars elucidate what it is to be an exemplar, what it is to be an admirable person, and roughly the same way that empirical science permits us to tell us what it is to be water, what it is to be gold, what it is to be a tiger, and so on.
Good. So let me Excellent. Let me ask. So there is a feature of the direct reference views that's more front-loaded or more central to the Putnam version, as I'm remembering, but still present in the Kripke. What Putnam calls the sort of division of semantic labor.
Oh, yes.
And, you know, it's got a version of this in Kripke with the baptism stuff, right, yeah, which does look like a communal act too. So could you bring the relevance of the communal aspect in?
Excellent. That's a good – I'm glad you asked that. I have a whole chapter on that.
Yes, it's a very good chapter.
Yes, so Putnam had this idea of the division of linguistic labor, and this is actually part of the way in which his semantics is externalist, meaning is outside there, at least partly outside the mind.
It's in the head.
It's partly in a community, in a linguistic community.
Right.
And the idea here was that we all succeed in referring to the same thing when we use a term like, say, titanium, because we are all connected to titanium through a social network that includes experts who have the function of picking out titanium. Certain people in the community have to be able to find the stuff. I mean, they have to be able to say, this is it. And they also have the function of explaining what makes titanium titanium. The rest of us don't have to know that at all. We succeed in referring to titanium because we're connected to a network where some people in the network can find titanium. So we in a sense, are semantically successful because some of us are semantically successful in finding the right stuff. But Putnam also thought that might look like we all get to be semantically successful for free, you know, like we don't have to do anything.
Right.
But he also had this idea of a stereotype where a competent user of a term has to be able to grasp what he calls a stereotype of the term. And what is in the stereotype is descriptive, but it doesn't give necessary and sufficient conditions for being a member of the kind. The stereotype is sort of the minimum descriptions that competent users of a term are supposed to grasp. So he suggests very famously that the stereotype of elm tree doesn't differ from the stereotype of beech tree. I believe he thinks that. He says he can't tell them apart. You know, he can't tell an elm tree from a beech tree. But that's okay, because the stereotype is thin enough that you don't have to be able to distinguish an elm tree from a beech tree in order to successfully use either term, elm tree or beech tree. But you do have to know something. I mean, you have to understand it's a tree. I don't know what else you have to grasp, but you have to grasp something minimal, something descriptively minimal to be able to competently use the terms elm tree and beech tree. Mm-hmm. And then he says something interesting about the term tiger. He says you don't competently grasp the term tiger if you don't know that tigers have stripes. Now, when you think about that, that seems to be a cultural decision, you know,
right,
that you just don't know what a tiger is if you don't know they have stripes. And that's, well, partly because the term tiger is used in our society is people are expected to have seen pictures of tigers, or they've seen tigers in zoos or something, and you're supposed to know that tigers have stripes, or you just didn't learn the term properly. So that's the division of linguistic labor, more or less, that there's a function for experts, and then ordinary speakers are supposed to grasp a stereotype. How thick or thin the stereotype is depends upon, well, just, you know, whatever this, you know, the culture decides. And I have something like that in my theory, what I call a division of moral linguistic labor, where I think that the division of moral linguistic labor operates differently for evaluative terms and virtue terms like good and fair and generous and honest than it does for deontic terms like wrong and duty. And for the evaluative terms, I think that there is a stereotype we're supposed to grasp. The stereotype is spread through the community through stories, through narratives. So if someone understands the word generous, they ought to be able to, you know, maybe tell a story about a generous person, or they've heard a story of a generous person that allows them to give some general description of what generous people are like. Again, it's not necessary in sufficient conditions. It just shows that they're properly plugged into the network of users of the term generous. So ordinary people should be able to grasp a stereotype, but there aren't experts in quite the same sense as Putnam thinks for scientific terms, for natural kind terms. I mean, we really don't have experts who have the final decision, the final say-so on who's a generous person and who's a fair person and so on. But I do think that we have a division of labor, and we actually have several different functions for different kinds of people in a moral linguistic community. So the storytellers I've already mentioned, being a storyteller is a linguistic, I think the storytellers actually perform a linguistic function in conveying the stereotype of virtue terms. Then I think, more recently, empirical scientists have a function in studying how widespread a virtue, the possession of a virtue is, whether people are consistently virtuous from one situation to another, whether there's people who have one virtue are more likely to have another, you know, that kind of stuff. Empirical scientists can serve that function. I think that philosophers have a function in the network. That is, they actually have a function in the moral linguistic network. And the function of philosophers is partly to find or pick out inconsistencies in the stereotype, clarifying the stereotype. And philosophers do something even more important in providing the moral reasoning to support the judgments of the exemplars that the people in the community recognize. So there's different functions for different groups of people in the moral linguistic network. And I actually think of this network as having explaining the semantics of the moral terms. It explains how it is that we are connected to the same thing when we talk, use these moral terms.
Well, excellent. So that clears up a lot of the architecture of the view. Can we talk a little bit about some of the earlier chapters where you examine exemplars, and you're interested particularly in cases of exemplars that are heroes and saints and sages. Can you tell us a little bit about? I mean, that's a very it's nice to read a book in moral philosophy that has actual narrative content about people who I think are undeniably morally admirable. Can you tell us a little bit about some of that work?
Sure. So let me start by saying that there's an obvious way in which the set of exemplars differs from water and tigers and gold. The set of exemplars includes a number of different kinds of people whom we find admirable. I assume that one bit of water is just like any other bit of water, leaving out impurities. Mm-hmm. They're all the same, and the same for pieces of gold, but that's not the case for exemplars. And that just, that makes it more complicated because we then have to investigate not just one exemplar, but many, many of them to really get an idea of the different varieties of admirability. So I propose that there's three kinds of exemplars. I don't actually mean that there are only three kinds. There could be others. But the three kinds of exemplars that I discuss in the book are, as you mentioned, heroes, saints, and sages. And each one probably is dominated by a particular virtue. So heroes, I would say they're dominated by the virtue of courage. They're supremely courageous. Saints, maybe that's a little harder because what I propose is it's something like love or, you know, charity. But the saints may have many other virtues as well. But if there is a dominant one, it might be compassion or love. And then sages, of course, would be dominated by the virtue of wisdom. Now, you could argue that both saints and sages have virtually all of the virtues, or anyway, most of them, as well as their dominant virtue. It's different in the case of heroes. Heroes, sometimes we find heroes interesting because they have obvious defects. Not all of them, of course, but many of them have obvious defects. So the heroes are actually a little different than the saints and the sages. But I think we can examine them all using the same methodology. So what I suggest is that if we're following my proposal to pick them out by the emotion of admiration and then use narratives and empirical studies to elucidate what it is we admire about them, then, you know, we're going to need stories and we're going to need to refer to some empirical studies right in the, you know, in the theory itself. So I do that a bit with examples of exemplars in each of the three categories. So for heroes, my example is Leopold Socha, mm-hmm. who is a Holocaust rescuer in Poland, and he hid Jews in the sewers of Lwów for 14 months. And managed to save something like more than a dozen. I can't remember exactly how many he was able to save. And he did this at great personal risk. There's a movie about them called In Darkness. There's a couple of biographies about him that I've read. It's a fascinating, a really fascinating story.
And one of the features of that story is, as you were saying, you know, that heroes can be internally morally conflicted or in some ways morally ambiguous. He himself didn't have all of the virtues, it seems.
No, he didn't. He started, actually, this is part of what makes this so interesting.
Yeah.
He was a thief. He was a petty thief. And he, when he began to hide Jews in the sewers, he was a sewer inspector, so that's how he was able to pull this off. But when he began to hide the Jews in the sewer, he did it for money.
Right.
They offered him money to do it, but when their money ran out, he just kept right on doing it.
Right.
And he did it out of love. And another thing that's interesting is that he started by having a probably just the kind of vague anti-Semitic feelings of the people in Lwów at the time. But somehow those feelings disappeared and grew into a very strong personal bond with the people that he was hiding in the sewers.
Right.
Yeah. What I do in that chapter about the different kinds of exemplars is I give a brief narrative for each one. So for the hero, it's Leopold Socha, as I said. For the saint, it's Jean Vanier, the founder of the L'Arche communities where people live with the mentally disabled and give them a rich home life. And this movement has spread to every continent. And I don't remember how many there are, but there's well over 150 of these communities in the world. And so he's my example of the saint. He's a living saint, so I don't know if you're allowed to call somebody a saint.
We'll have to ask the Vatican.
Yeah. And And then for the sage, my example is Confucius, as depicted in the Analects. So I have a brief narrative for each kind of exemplar, and then that's followed up with empirical studies that I know of in each category. So there are some interesting empirical studies of Holocaust rescuers. Some of them are actual interviews and surveys that compare the rescuers from non-rescuers and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. There's also the group that I'm a consultant for has done some, invented some, what they call a rescuer game that people play in a laboratory in an fMRI machine. So their brains are being scanned while they play the game. And it's meant, they want to see like what the differences are between people who rescue in their rescuer game and those who don't, and what, how that's correlated with other behaviors and, if you can find any, find what areas of the brain are activated when they're making the rescuing decision, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So we have that bit of evidence. This is very early on that this kind of brain imaging is done of rescuers, but that's some that I know of. And then there's empirical studies of the people, the volunteers in the L'Arche communities. Again, they're mostly surveys, interviews, and that sort of thing. But they're quite illuminating. Kevin Reimer has a good book on these people and their psychological characteristics. And then for the sages, I just refer to some of the recent work on wisdom. Wisdom studies is becoming really big. Ages, nobody did anything on wisdom. And now there are quite a few studies on wisdom and wise persons, and so I refer to some of that work too.
Yeah, and I take it that one of the things that you say a couple of times throughout the book is that this sort of empirical side of the theory is has the advantage maybe of being revisable in light of the, as new empirics come in, mm-hmm. you can update the theory and learn more about what our admiration is being attracted to in light of new scientific and psychological studies, right?
I think that's right. And I guess I have to say, I still think, in spite of all the fascinating empirical studies that are going on, I still think that narratives tell us more.
Right.
Narratives, films, that it's a medium that really can penetrate the human mind, if done well, it can really penetrate the human mind very well and reveal, the motivational structure of a person that would help us to understand, to grasp what it is about them that attracts our admiration.
Right. Excellent. So let's lead up on that then. And you had mentioned a bit earlier the tight connection that exemplarism as a moral theory is able to forge between two things that look like they ought to go very closely together, but a lot of other moral theories, in fact, it seems to be, have a hard time putting together the view they offer of moral assessment and what they want to say or what they need to say about moral education and moral development. But it mm-hmm. looks like these things are from the very get-go in exemplarism very tightly tethered. Can you tell us a little bit about emulation?
Yes. Thanks for asking about that. I think that one of the advantages of the approach I have is that it naturally fits with the way moral learning ordinarily happens. I mean, we learn almost everything through imitation. Mm-hmm. And I think of emulation as a form of imitation in which we're imitating something that we want to be like. So emulation is actually already you might say, a natural way in which human beings learn. And by having a theoretical structure based on people we want to emulate, I think I can tie together the theoretical map I've described with moral education, with something that would stimulate us to want us to be moral, not just to understand morality, but to want to be a better person. So I think that emulation is, not only the natural way people learn, but it fits very well with a theory, a moral theory based on admiration.
Right. So emulation, then, just to get a little more detail in. So emulation, on your view, involves a kind of modeling of the mm-hmm. right. That's how it's distinguished from just copying or imitation, where right. you don't have to have a model of the thing. Mm-hmm. Just a point of clarification, though. I wonder if some listeners to what you've said so far might be wondering whether. Admiration or a sense of the admirable. Can you explain how, in your theory, we can admire the wrong things?
Oh, yes. I'll say some more about emulation in a minute, because I don't think I fully answered your question. But we can admire the wrong things. I mean, I think that it's very important to be reflective about admiration.
Right.
I think that our only way to tell that someone is admirable is that we admire them on reflection. But that means on reflection. So there has to be, we can revise the people we find admirable. And we can do that. It actually happens often automatically just by finding out more about them. But I discuss the ways admiration can, go wrong in the chapter on admiration. We can admire people who aren't admirable, and we can fail to admire people who are admirable. I actually think that the problem of admiring the wrong people is actually less of a threat to our moral understanding and moral development than the problem that many people in our culture are suspicious of admiring anybody.
Right.
There's a kind of a psychology of wanting to sort of enjoying seeing the saint revealed as a hypocrite or something like that.
Right.
Wanting to think that there really are not morally superior people, because if there are, then that means there's a demand on me to be better. And, there is some resistance to that. So I think that even though I discussed a bit, about how we can revise our cultivate our emotion of admiration to make it more fitting of the admirable. But the threat that I find most worrisome is not that people sometimes admire the wrong people, but this problem I mentioned, that some people are very cynical about admirable people and reluctant to admire anybody.
Just to share a thought about that, I think that you're right, that is a very serious cultural force. It seems oddly accompanied, though, by an enhanced need to be admired by others.
Oh, is that right?
It seems to me, at least, that people more and more seek the explicit admiration of others, while at the same time they adopt a very cynical view about those who admire others.
Oh, that's very interesting. I'm not sure what to say. So they want to be admired themselves, but they're suspicious. Are they suspicious of people other people admire, or are they suspicious of people who admire other people?
I think a little bit of both.
Yeah.
They're both suspicious of admiration as such, but yet want to be the object of admiration. Yeah.
I don't know what that is there must be I suggest a kind of a story about how this works psychologically. Right. in the book. But I wonder, I mean, I didn't think of your phenomenon that you just mentioned.
Right.
And the only thing that comes to mind as a explanation for that is the modern view that people are equal and all equally good.
Right.
So I don't know if the reluctance to admire is a reluctance to admit anybody is superior to me. But of course, if I'm admired, then that's good, because then if other people are good, then at least I'm equal. You know, I'm I'm pretty good myself. So that's possible. I don't know.
Right. Well, did you want to pick up on emulation?
Oh, in the emulation chapter, I do talk about, you know, the psychological process of emulating, and particularly the process of or the question of whether a virtue can be acquired through emulation. And that's actually more complicated than it seems, because there's some interesting work on modeling that you mentioned, where you know you can model your behavior on someone else. But of course, a virtue isn't just behavior; it involves motives and emotions.
Right.
And so then the question can be: can you acquire an emotion by modeling yourself on a person who has that emotion? And I find that a very interesting question. And I suggest that one way to look at it, to think of how this could happen, is to look at how actors project themselves into the character they're playing.
Right.
And, you know, some actors actually, you know, I mean, I'm not an actor, but I'm told that some actors use the process of actually, you know, sort of internally becoming that person for a while during the course of the project, and where they actually kind of take on the feelings of the character they're playing,
right,
at least temporarily. And that kind of psychology suggests that there is something about, I mean, you, in a way you can, in imagination, actually acquire an emotion of a person you want, whose emotion you want to have. In that case, it's done temporarily, and it's not done in full seriousness. I mean, you know, it's done as acting. But that kind of process, I think, is close to the way someone could intentionally acquire an emotion of an exemplar by modeling. But then the hardest question has to do with, you know, that I don't want to talk about at length, but because it covers more than one chapter in my book, mm-hmm. which is the place of reasoning in virtue. If, you know, and then this depends upon what exemplars actually do. And I suggest we're going to have to actually do more research on exemplars to find out what the place of reasoning is in their behavior. Now, I suspect that many exemplars, and there's lots of evidence in the interviews of Holocaust rescuers, many of them did not engage in a process of reasoning at all.
Right.
If the reasoning was very short, it was, you know, here's somebody who needs to be saved from the Nazis, therefore I will do it. You know, there's no steps in between. So the question is, what does the virtuous person use reasoning? And if so, and if I'm a person who wants to become like the exemplar, then of course I'm going to have to learn the reasoning. And then I propose, if, you know, we have to do, I don't know the answers to these questions, like what the exemplars do, right, but just suppose they do use a process of reasoning, we're not going to learn the process of reasoning by emulation. So I think you can learn behavior by emulation, you can acquire motives and emotions by emulation, but the reasoning is actually not by emulation. We learn that in a different way. We learn, you know, you can learn moral reasoning actually fairly easily in a philosophy class.
Yeah, good thing. It gives us a job.
It gives us something to do, right. But as I said, I rather doubt that exemplars actually do engage in reasoning. And so the purpose of reasoning, I think, actually is not in the process or in the virtue, in the possession of the virtue. I think the process of reasoning is being so partly social. It's what, you know, what we do, what philosophers do as a service to the community, mm-hmm. to explain and justify the judgments that the exemplars make. But the exemplars don't actually use that reasoning.
Right. So that's the philosophers, or maybe particularly the moral philosophers' role in the community
moral linguistic community I was describing a minute ago. Yeah.
Well, Linda, you've been very generous with your time, and listeners, there's a whole lot of really fascinating philosophical material in Linda's book that we haven't touched upon. So I encourage everyone to go out and pick up a copy and read it. So since you've been so generous with your time, just as a final question, what's the next project for you, Linda?
Well, there are a couple of projects. There probably are going to be some follow-up projects, interdisciplinary projects on exemplars, which I can't describe yet because I'm not even sure exactly how they're going to be, how they're going to be constituted. But I also am working on a project for the Su Chau Lectures, which I'll be giving in a year. And that project will be a book called The Two Greatest Ideas.
Oh, right. The
now,
two greatest ideas.
I don't know what the two greatest ideas are. I will tell you. So my idea is that there are two ideas so important that they basically undergird all of the intellectual discoveries of human civilization. The first idea, and they're also very simple, and they're so simple that they're not noticed.
Right.
And the first idea is the idea that the human mind can grasp the universe. And the second idea is the idea that the human mind can grasp itself.
Huh.
And what I do is to give kind of a story of the history of ideas as a story of the interplay between these two ideas. I mean, for starting out with the first great idea, you know, dominated through most of human history, mm-hmm. at least in the West. And then sometime in the early modern period, the second great idea became dominant. And I think that and I don't want to say there's a battle for dominance, but there's a tension between the two great ideas that has not been resolved.
Sure.
And then I will go through a series of philosophical questions, philosophical issues, where the clash of the two great ideas really leads to confusion about the idea or about the problem, and then do my best to see what we can say about that.
Well, that sounds fascinating and refreshingly ambitious. in a time where philosophy, I think, especially in certain fields, tries to make a virtue of a kind of lowering the sights for what philosophy can do. It's refreshing to see to hear about this project that is so grand.
Well, thank you very much. And I mean, and I just want to say, I don't think there's anything wrong with lowering the sights for certain purposes. And, you know, I think,
right.
You know, I've done that myself and that's fine. It's just that I guess I'm changing now. Maybe I'm just getting old.
Well, Linda, thank you so much for your time today and for talking to us about this book.
Well, thank you very much, Bob. I appreciate it.
And thank you, listeners, for joining us for the discussion of Linda Zagzabsky's book, Exemplarist Moral Theory. Again, Linda's book is published by Oxford University Press. Bye for now.